headlines this hour. The French President Emmanuel Macron says Ukraine must win the war against Russia, while Moscow warns against new Western weapons supplies to Ukraine, calling it useless. Bank of England raises interest rates for the fifth time in a row in a bid to contain soaring inflation. And a senior Iranian diplomat says that Tehran will not allow the Israeli regime to promote Iranophobia and legitimize its anti-Iran agenda. This is News. Thanks for joining us. The leaders of France, Germany, and Italy are in Kiev in what's being seen as a gesture of Western support for Ukraine. The German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, the French President Emmanuel Macron, and the Italian Prime Minister Mario Draghi arrived in Kiev by train. Upon arrival, Macron told reporters that Ukraine must resist and win the war against Russia. The three officials are meeting with President Zelensky at a time when Kiev is pushing to join the European Union. The European Commission is expected to give its recommendations on Kiev's membership prospects soon. Meanwhile, Russia says it hopes the visit is not just for pumping arms to Ukraine. The Kremlin said sending more weapons will only further damage the country and prolong the people's suffering. Secretary General of the SIPPI Foundation, Paolo Raffone, joined us earlier. He says the visit by three European leaders to Kiev represents the EU's different political sensitivities regarding Ukraine.
The three head of government who have been or are visiting Ukraine, in fact, represent different sensitivities on the possibility to continue supporting Ukraine. The problem here is what is the end? Where are we going? What we want to achieve? And these three governments have different opinions on this issue. Moreover, the European sentiment is evidently split. It just came out yesterday, an ECFR research that shows that Europeans are deeply divided, with 35% requesting peace, which means end the war as soon as possible, and only 25% requesting justice, which means pressing more to get to a point to punish Russia. And this is clear in the minds of governments. It's not so much clear in the minds of the EU leadership, which is mostly on the shadow of a NATO approach, which is dictated by the United States. So further support, military support to Ukraine.
The United States stock indices take a sharp nosedive after the Federal Reserve reports its biggest interest rate hike since 1994. The Dow Jones, S&P 500, along with NASDAQ, Composite, and other growth shares all slumped. On Wednesday, the Federal Reserve approved the largest interest rate increase, signaling an aggressive path to fight 40-year high inflations. This after the May Consumer Price Index showed inflation rose to well over 8%. The Federal Reserve has shifted gears this year, from propping up the U.S. economy during the pandemic to trying to plug off a surge in consumer prices. Meanwhile, the Bank of England has hiked its main interest rates for a fifth straight time as it forecasts inflation to soar further this year to above 11%. The bank raised the cost of borrowing by a quarter point to 1.25%. That is the highest level since the global financial crisis in 2009. The pound slumped 1% against the dollar following the announcement. Currently, inflation in Britain stands at 9%, the highest level in 40 years. Data this week also revealed the first rise in the UK unemployment rate since the end of 2020. The war in Ukraine and subsequent energy crisis, as well as an economy still battered by the pandemic, are among the main reasons for Britain's economic woes. Britain says the European Court of Human Rights overstepped its powers in grounding a flight of asylum seekers minutes before it took off to Rwanda. The Deputy Prime Minister Dominic Raab says that London will keep working to make sure the deportation flights will take place in the weeks ahead. The UK government is planning to send migrants arriving in the country thousands of kilometers away to Rwanda, but the decision has triggered massive criticism from the UN, the Church of England, and rights groups. On Tuesday, the European Court canceled the first flight with a last-minute ruling. The legal battle has led some in Prime Minister Boris Johnson's Conservative Party to call for Britain to pull out of the European Convention on Human Rights. But Rob says for now, London will stay in the convention. The Donbas region in eastern Ukraine has become the flashpoint of the war between Moscow and Kiev in recent weeks. We're now joined by a correspondent, Johnny Miller from Donetsk, for the latest developments. Well, Johnny, at this point, I know the biggest news is about the visit by those three European officials, namely Macron, to be one of them. But give us the developments on the ground before any reactions that you may have had on their visit and whether they're united in the way that they are supporting Kiev in terms of this war.
Well, yeah, the situation on the ground is pretty much unchanged from yesterday. At the moment, a bit of a lull in fighting around Donetsk as the Russians tried to evacuate civilians from the area. Now, they've made up evacuation routes going to the Russian side only, and they're worried about soldiers trying to get out, Ukrainian soldiers trying to get out with with the civilians. Both sides have accused each other of shelling the evacuation route. It's unclear who's to blame. But there's a bit of a lull there. It's good for the Ukrainians in a way, because Ukraine needs time at the moment. They need time to get Western weapon artillery pieces to the front line. And this this hold up at this other steel plant in Severodonetsk with the civilians and soldiers still there is buying them a little bit more time. In terms of the three European leaders coming to Kiev today, for those hoping that these three leaders may be pushing Ukraine into negotiations and to cede some territory in order to end this conflict, at least publicly, these people will be disappointed. All three leaders have stated their continued support to Ukraine. Macron saying that Ukraine must win. France also saying they're going to supply more artillery pieces to Ukraine. So at least officially, these three European powerhouses are still putting their full support behind Ukraine. There is some feeling that behind the scenes, they may have a different policy to other NATO countries like America and Britain and Poland. But if so, that's very much behind the scenes. On the surface, they're staying resolutely behind Ukraine.
And we're still looking at Donbas almost being in control of Russia. I'm curious as to when, if and when Russia takes over that area completely, what would that look like? I mean, what are we looking at when Russia actually has that area in its full control?
Well, that's the big problem. I mean, Russia is winning the war in Donbass. Unless there's a major change on the battlefield, they will be able to take over the rest of Donbass. But that's the big kind of if. Because at some point, you would expect Russia to call an end to what it calls a special military operation. But now there's been comments today from the head of the DPR, Pushilin, saying that because, Lavrov, Sergei Lavrov, has said the same thing, that if NATO continues to supply long-range artillery, then Russia is going to have to push much further outside the boundaries of Donbass in order to stop those artillery pieces hitting Donbass. So it's unclear. It's been always been very unclear what Russia's aims are in Ukraine, how much of Ukraine they wanted to take over. Have those war aims changed because of what's happened on the battlefield and because of Ukraine's fierce defense? But Russia and the DPR still very, very confident to win this war and even talking about pushing further. Some Russians I've spoken to, I spoke to a Russian member of parliament recently near the front line. I ran into him. He says that Russia is not worried about taking over even if Ukraine is negotiating table. And there's a feeling that NATO wants to continue to fight with Russia and so may well stop Ukraine negotiating. Russia's adamant that it will just keep fighting and pushing Ukraine even further back. So it's very unclear. Day to day, week to week, we're going to find out more developments.
Thank you for that. Johnny Miller from Donetsk, we appreciate it. Moving on, the EU and UK edge ever closer to an all-out trade war over post-Brexit border arrangements relating to Northern Ireland. Brussels and London are refusing to back down regarding the future of the so-called Northern Ireland Protocol. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
The EU is Britain's largest trading partner by some distance, and the UK is the EU's third largest customer for goods. Therefore, there's a great deal to lose if relations continue to deteriorate.
This is illegal.
The 27-nation bloc is furious at plans by the British government to rip up the post-Brexit trade agreement relating to Northern Ireland agreed in 2020. Apparently, Boris Johnson's proposals would create a mountain of paperwork for businesses in Northern Ireland.
I mean, go and ask, the milk producers in Northern Ireland how he or she can produce the milk, one sort for EU, another one for the UK, or any kind of manufacturer who wants to benefit from the access to both markets of the UK and the EU.
Brussels is taking London to court for not fulfilling the terms of the so-called Northern Ireland Protocol. The mechanism is designed to prevent border checks between the North and the Republic of Ireland, thereby avoiding the potential for sectarian violence. The United States is siding with the EU on this issue, which means London has limited options when it comes to finding new, big trading partners. Currently, just 15% of UK exports go to the US. And according to analysts, it would take years for London and Washington to agree on a new trade deal. EU leaders simply do not trust the British government any longer. Analysts have been surprised by the bloc's unity throughout the Brexit process after the EU spelled out its red lines.
And the EU has been very consistent in keeping to those red lines, probably more unified than anyone expected. Whereas on the other side, we have seen huge divisions.
This protocol presents for Northern Ireland.
It's been suggested, for political reasons, Johnson cannot back down now, and therefore it would ultimately require a change of government in London to avoid a trade war. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The senior Iranian diplomat says the Islamic Republic will not allow the Israeli regime to promote Iranophobia and legitimize its anti-Iran campaign. Deputy Foreign Minister Ali Bagheri said that Tehran has successfully countered the U.S.'s so-called maximum pressure policy. Elsewhere in his remarks, the top official said that Iran's diplomacy is marked by strategic prudence, bold decision-making, and strong action. He said among other key features of Tehran's diplomacy is paying attention to a variety of economic deals and trade partners, as well as stable economic relations. He further noted that Iran's diplomacy will not compromise on national interests and security. Iran says a recent resolution by the IAEA's Board of Governors against Tehran was planned by the United States to draw concessions from the Islamic Republic in the JCPOA revival talks. Iran's foreign minister says the resolution was first raised by Washington with the IAEA at a time when Tehran and the White House are exchanging messages through the European Union. Hossein Amir Abdullahian said that Iran has even offered a political initiative to allow the talks to bear fruit. But he said the U.S. went for a resolution and, as a result, Iran expanded its nuclear activities as stipulated in a 2020 parliamentary law. The Iranian minister said Tehran believes diplomacy is the best path towards a good deal, but it will react strongly to bullying behavior. Iran says the IAEA resolution adopted last week is based on fabricated information provided by the Israeli regime. Tehran has also shut down a member of the agency's cameras, or a number of the agency's cameras at its nuclear sites, that had been installed as part of voluntary trust-building measures. Russia, Turkey, and Iran have met again under the Astana format to discuss Syria. The three parties have reaffirmed commitment to the sovereignty and territorial integrity of the Arab country. In a joint statement following their 18th such meeting, three countries condemned the increased activities of terrorist groups in Syria. They said that they are determined to continue working together to combat terrorism in the Arab country. The three countries said that they have agreed to make further efforts to ensure calm in the de-escalation area of Syria's Idlib. According to the joint statement, the next Astana meeting on Syria will be held in Kazakhstan in the second half of this year. Meanwhile, a senior Iranian diplomat has urged the international community to send more aid to Syria. Ali Asghar Khaji, a senior advisor to Iran's foreign minister, made the remarks in a meeting with the UN delegation to the 18th Astana meeting on Syria. The Iranian diplomat called for an immediate removal of Washington's sanctions on Syria. The diplomat also urged an end to the illegal presence of U.S. forces in Syria, who are accused of plundering the country's natural resources. The Iranian diplomat also condemned Israel's acts of aggression against Syria. The Israeli regime is planning to confiscate a vast part of Palestinian land in the occupied West Bank. According to Palestinian sources, Tel Aviv intends to seize some 1,000 square kilometers of Palestinian territories from Al-Quds all the way to the Dead Sea. The Israeli regime plans to construct a large park for its citizens in what is being viewed as its largest expansionist program. If implemented, the project can change the geographical and political structure of the region. It will also eliminate the possibility of establishing an independent Palestinian state in the future. The Saudi-led coalition seizing a second Yemeni fuel ship in less than 24 hours, despite a UN-brokered truce. According to the Yemeni oil company, the ship was carrying over 30,000 tons of gasoline. The company's spokesman says the coalition prevented the tanker from entering the port of Hodeidah, even though it had a UN clearance and had been fully inspected. Also on Wednesday, coalition forces impounded another tanker. Yemeni people have been living under a blockade and war for more than 7 years and are in urgent need of food, fuel, and medicine. A ceasefire has been in place for more than 2 months, which, based on offensive military operations and the siege on Yemen, have to be halted. But the Yemeni side has been complaining of repeated Saudi violations since then. Political commentator Hossein Abulkhaiti explains how many fuel tankers are allowed to dock at the Hodeidah port under the truce, and why exactly Saudi Arabia is violating the deal.
They haven't allowed all the ships to come into Yemen, even though the agreement says that they should allow 18 ships in the first period of the truce, and as well 18 ships in the second period. But Saudi has blocked most of the ships from entering Yemen, and as we know that Yemeni forces have not fired a single attack against Saudi Arabia since the truce has begun. They have not attacked either Saudi land, either as well in the Saudi border. But on the other hand, we see that the Saudi keep actually shelling Yemeni border by artillery shell on a daily basis. Just in the last 48 hours, two civilians were killed north of Saada because of the Saudi artillery shell on Shada area. That's why I think if the Saudi will continue to obstruct this truce, I'm sure that Yemeni forces will conduct a major and a full attack against Saudi, especially oil infrastructure, because Saudi is trying to force Yemeni civilians to submission by blocking the fuel ship and food ship from entering Hodeidah port.
And that is for this edition of World News. It's bye bye for now.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. in the limelight.
What is happening in Palestine is not removed from what is happening in the US with its increased gun violence. The consequences of the gun lobby and weapons manufacturers in the US have destructive and deeply unjust consequences all over the world, including in the murder of Shirin Abu Aghaleh. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Yusra Bitar, writer. This article is published under the heading Big Players in Finance Profited from Gun Used to Kill Shirin Abu Aghaleh. Stay tuned for the second part of this article, please. Although not surprising given the role overseeing a gun company, it is worth mentioning that these board members are tied to major reactionary forces in the US that contribute to preventing actions in response to the increasing number of mass shootings. Sandy Foreman has a lifetime position at NRA Executive Council and has been on their board since 1992. She also served as the NRA's vice president from 1998 to 2005 and president from 2005 to 2007. Roger is a frequent donor to the NRA. In 2011, they pledged $1 for the NRA for every Roger gun sold as part of its first million gun challenge. By the end of the campaign in 2012, Roger had donated $1.2 million to the NRA. In 2015 and 2016, Sturm Roger directed $10 million to the NRA and $1.5 million in the following 2 years. Sturm Roger CEO Chris Calloy is on the National Shooting Sports Foundation NSSF Board of Governors. The NSSF calls itself the Firearm Industry Trade Association. Benefiting from gun sales from multiple angles, Calloy is also a board member for Velocity Outdoor, another manufacturer of rifles, pistol, and ammunition products. In 2021, he was compensated $3,435,000 by Roger, and he took in $9,557,993 from the company between 2019 and 2021 in total. His 150,395 shares of Roger's stock, as reported in Roger's 2022 proxy filing alone, are worth close to $10 million as of June 6, 2022. Philip Whitman is on the board of Vecross Incorporation, which ranks in the top 10 arms manufacturers in the world. Oddly, these directors who profit from destructive weapons are able to burnish their reputations through other positions. For example, Ronald Whitaker, according to his page, is on the advisory board on the Indiana University for the Manufacturing Policy Initiative, which is part of the Public and Environmental Affairs School. He is also, again, according to his LinkedIn page, the vice chair of the Savannah Music Festival in Georgia. Georgia is one of the states with a guns everywhere bill that was signed into law in 2014. Savannah witnesses gun violence often. Its state university had a shooting this past April. Roger describes itself as a company of arms makers for responsible citizens and as a model of corporate and community responsibility. But the truth is that the weapons they produce and distribute are used against journalists, unarmed protesters, children, and other communities. In its latest proxy statement, Roger also reaffirmed its deep commitment to human rights. Ironically, their filing also shows that the company opposed a proposal to uphold the UN guiding principles on business, and human rights by committing for a human rights impact assessment, which a majority of shareholders ultimately voted for. The company stated that it opposed this resolution because the outcome that proponents advocate and actually seek will harm the company, destroy shareholder value, and undermine the Second Amendment rights of the company's customers. The proposal shareholders approved is non-binding. The risk factors in the company's annual report specify that misconducts, fraud, or improper activities by employees or contractors could have a material adverse impact on business and reputation. Such misconduct could include the failure to comply with federal, state, local, or foreign government procurement regulations. But in the case of Shirin Abu Aghla's murder, the misconduct committed by its client and customer, the Zionist regime, goes against international law. Human rights experts, for example, have said for her killing may constitute a war crime. Roger and Smith and Wesson, another major gun manufacturer, are being pressured by other nations as well as around the harm caused by their gun business. For example, Mexico filed a $10 billion lawsuit against the companies last August, holding them responsible for the deadly floods of weapons crossing into the country. It's not far-fetched to suggest that tragedy, crisis, and mass discontent have left companies like Roger at an advantage. Gun sales in the U.S. increased significantly during the pandemic. Based on their proxy statement filings, Roger's sales increased 28% in 2021 compared to 2020, with production also increasing 30% and earnings increasing 73% in that period. The share prices of gun and ammunition companies often rise after mass shootings, and investors often anticipate a spike in sales ahead of calls for stricter gun laws. Roger gained more than 4% after the deadly shooting in Uvalde, Texas. Simply put, Roger profits from selling weapons that are involved in the death and oppression of people around the world. The upward trend of guns and military budgets in the U.S. is also reflected in the increasing military aid the country gives the Zionist regime unconditionally. The U.S. is the biggest supplier of military aid to the fabricated regime of Israel. According to the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, SIPRI, 83% of the Zionist regime's arms imports came from the U.S. between 1950 to 2020. Also, 80% of all aid that the U.S. regime has sent the Zionist regime since 1967 has come in the form of military aid. In 2020 alone, the U.S. provided $3.8 billion, which is part of a greater and larger $38 billion deal over a 10-year period. Despite the Leahy Law in the U.S. that prohibits the export of U.S. defense articles to military units being used in human rights abuses, no Israeli regime unit has been held accountable under this law. These military aid deals are used to purchase weapons from companies like Roger. The campaign No Roger Guns to the Israeli regime has documented over 200 cases of Palestinians being killed or injured by Roger guns. Sturm Roger is directly benefiting from the gun violence in the U.S. and abroad. Its close connection to the NRA helps it push for policies such as less gun control that advances its profit-making. What is happening in Palestine is not removed from what is happening in the U.S. with its increased gun violence. The consequences of the gun lobby and weapons manufacturers in the U.S. have destructive and deeply unjust consequences all over the world, including in the murder of Shirin Abu Aghla. Roger is one of the stakeholders personally invested in the upkeep of the hyper-militarized and over-weaponized societies and major firms. And firms like BlackRock and Vanguard prop up and benefit from the company's business. Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Welcome to Leith, directed by Michael Beach Nichols and Christopher K. Walker. And joining me in the studio, we have Rich Klein, who is the Vice Chair of the London Film Critics Circle and the Chair of the Critics Circle Film Awards. And beside him is Marcel Cartier, who's an independent journalist and a hip-hop recording artist. Now, Welcome to Leith is a documentary that chronicles the takeover of a tiny town called Leith in North Dakota, a Midwestern state in the US, by the notorious white supremacist Craig Cobb, who buys up the land to create a sanctuary for his followers and terrorizes the local residents. When Cobb's takeover plans become evident, the small community rallies to save their town from Cobb's band of white supremacists, and the two groups clash over their ideals for the place they call home.
First got here, he turned around and asked me, did we have any land for sale?
I had no idea what his ultimate plan was.
Well-known white supremacist Craig Cobb plans to turn Leith into a white nationalist community.
Here we can gather together and become a simple majority by legal electoral rights.
We live here, we breathe here, our kids grow up here.
That's white Americans hating on us, who are also white Americans.
They simply will not allow us to keep one another's company freely and openly.
If we weren't getting harassed so much, we wouldn't have to do this.
Tom and Dutton both have rifles.
You're running us out of this damn town.
Welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. So that was the Welcome to Leith trailer. And I must say, this documentary gives you a really chilling insight into far-right extremism in the US and also raises many questions about this notion of American do-it-yourself ideals. Rich, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on this film?
It's a really, really well-made documentary. And what I liked about it was that it doesn't put the bad guys into a corner. It lets them talk and express themselves, and they become kind of weirdly flesh and blood people. You can't just vilify them, which makes them even more kind of insidious. It's very well made. It puts you right in the middle of the situation. You feel everything, and it's really very gripping
indeed.
Yeah, and the characters in it, you know, that main guy, Craig Cobb, with the crazy hair, is one of the most riveting people you've seen on film in a long time, in any kind of film, and he's just terrifying, because the things that come out of his mouth, which they couldn't put in the trailer, are really horrifying.
And so, Marcel, if I could turn to you, what was your take on this documentary?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's ever more relevant in the age of Trump, where people such as Commander Jeff Shupp of the National Socialist Movement, who's very prevalent in this film because he actually owns, I believe, to this day, some of the land that Craig Cobb had actually purchased, you know, in creating this or trying to create this white supremacist community. And of course, the NSM and Shupp were so involved in the Charlottesville protest, mm-hmm. the so-called Unite the Right protest, in which an anti-fascist protester was killed. And Donald Trump, he seems to embolden these type of figures today. You know, under Barack Obama, it was a very different situation, but I think we also saw a situation during the Obama presidency where a lot of these white supremacists used the fact that there was the first black president to say, okay, well, we're losing our country. And actually, the KKK and other groups like this use that as a tremendous recruiting tool But in the age of Trump, it's just become so much more mainstream. These people feel like they can essentially come out of the closet, say, do whatever they want, and now kill actually with impunity almost. And it's very terrifying.
And I just wanted to ask you, Marcel, following from that clip, IndieWire, the film review website, said that Welcome to Leith is a, quote, stunning portrait of First Amendment rights pushed to their extremes. What does it mean by this, and what do you think?
Right, well, the so-called, you know, freedom of speech, being able to say the most sort of hate-filled things and get away with that. I think what's very interesting about the film, actually, is that you see that very small town. There's only one black resident, as far as I know, and he, you know, is very prevalent in the film.
You feel really scared for him, I think.
Yeah. You know, people are absolutely terrified. But, you know, what's also very interesting is that the majority of the residents who are actually white, they also feel terrified by this white supremacist group. They don't feel as if, you know, they have anything in common with them. So, you know, it shows you just how, on the one hand, alienating these type of people can be, even to the white community. And, you know, we often talk about how rural America is a very racist place, and perhaps to some extent that's true, but you also see this white community pushing back against these white supremacists, along with, you know, of course, when there's the protests, you have the indigenous communities from Standing Rock coming and protesting as well.
We're going to delve into those scenes a bit later on, and just going to move on briefly for now.
Well-known white supremacist Craig Cobb plans to turn Leith into a white nationalist community.
It would be extraordinarily beautiful when people enter the town, because we will have floodlit flags of all of the formerly white nations of Europe.
Cobb says like-minded people with white nationalist organizations will be taking up residence on his properties, so they'll have the majority of votes to take over the town.
What we're trying to do is move people into an area where they can get jobs at $50,000 a year almost immediately.
Cobb has a plan that, as crazy as it sounds, might actually happen.
He purchased one parcel and another parcel, and he finally got up to 12 to 13 parcels of land. He had the whole town mapped out as to what he was going to build on each piece of land that he owns. And after I see the map, it was very scary.
Here we can gather together and become a simple majority by legal electoral rights within the United States.
Rich, I want to talk about Craig Cobb a little bit more in this section. We've talked about the general issues. What did you make of his character?
Well, I mean, he's just a fascinating character because he's kind of this insidious villain. And he finds this tiny little town that has 24 residents. It's a tiny place. And he just quietly starts buying up all the land. And he's going to move all of his white supremacist buddies in so that they have a majority and they can take it over legally and become, you know, the politicians of this neighborhood, which would give them a foothold in the state government. And I mean, it's quite a terrifying thing when you look at what they're planning to do.
This town in North Dakota, Leith, it's, you get this overwhelming sense by his presence. It's so secluded, and I think the cinematography of the film was really well done. Did you have any thoughts on that as well?
No, it's very well shot because it really portrays this town as being this tiny, tiny little place. There's also a lot of jobs in the area because of all the fracking that goes on and the oil company in the vicinity. So that's another thing he's looking at. He's thinking, we can bring all of these people here. They have jobs. They have a place that they can take over politically. Mm-hmm. So there are jobs. It's not like it's a horribly depressed area. But it's people basically who just don't want to live in a city or even a town. I mean, this isn't really a town. 24 people, you can hardly call it a town. Mm-hmm. But it's, so you get this guy, this kind of crazy-haired, very sly. He's got a sense
quite
of humor.
Quite narcissistic.
He's got a sense of humor. He's very witty and kind of dry. And he's, you just don't trust him the second you see him. And no one in the town does either. They all think, what's he up to? Mm-hmm. And then when they see what he's up to, they respond to it.
And I think it's really disturbing how self-aware he is, actually, of his racism. He's quite proud of that fact. Marcel, what did you make of his character in this documentary?
It's very interesting, and actually, just based on what you said right there, you know, when you see somebody like Craig Cobb before he cuts the hair off, he looks insidious and he looks crazy and he looks scary. But then when we see him towards the end and he's clean-shaven, haven, and he seems to be such a reasonable person. You have to think to yourself, you know, how many people are there in society that we may meet on a daily basis, especially in the United States or rural America, and perhaps they harbor these same sort of white supremacist views. And, you know, it makes me think of the so-called alt-right and this rebranding of white supremacy, this rebranding of fascism and hatred under this, you know, more mainstream banner. So, you know, it's perhaps easy to look at somebody like Craig Cobb and say, okay, well, that guy's a racist and that guy's a nut job. But they understand very well how to tap into the, you know, the desires and the frustrations and the dissatisfactions, I think, of white people in, you know, working class America. And that's the scariest part.
Early on in the film, he's talking about genocide. He's talking about, right, we're being genocided, the white people were all being killed off, which is just ridiculous. And he's saying we need to kill all the Jews. I mean, he says that.
I was going to ask,
film,
how can he see which is just, as a victim?
Actually, those words come out of his mouth, and you just think, he says this on camera, and you're kind of shocked. Later on, he's very reasonable, and he's talking about balance in society, and you think, ooh, he's still the same man,
right,
but he's now learned how to use the media,
exactly,
and how to present himself as a more reasonable person, which is really terrifying.
And I want to pick up a point you made, actually, Marcel. Mm. We learn from the documentary that Cobb came from quite a decent upbringing. His mother was a teacher. His father was a rich land developer. Mm. And then it makes you think, how could someone from that sort of upbringing, not that there's any excuse for racism or to explain it, but how could he harvest so much hatred?
Right. Well, I mean, I think, you know, again, like the white supremacist notions that are prevalent in this film and the, you know, Cobb holds dear. I mean, you know, the United States was created off the genocide of the indigenous people. The United States was built on slavery. So, you know, these are very American concepts, actually. And, you know, for the economic situation in particular to be changing in the United States, where, of course, the gap between the rich and the poor is becoming wider, the middle class is eroding. This is exactly what Donald Trump tapped into in the electoral campaign. You know, if you look at the areas that he, you know, campaigned in and places that he actually won huge support, a lot of it was among the white working class, you know, where jobs are perhaps no longer existent in certain communities, deindustrialization, jobs going abroad. And this is something that Cobb talks about. He says, well, look, you know, we'll have people move into this community and they'll immediately be given jobs, you know, with a salary of $50,000. So there's, I think, a substantial economic component to all of this, where it's saying, okay, well, you know, the situation in the country is quite bad at the moment economically. You know, come here and, you know, you can live this this fantastic life, and, you know, we can have
the American
white
dream,
Aryan
the
society.
White American
that,
exactly.
We'll be taking our country back, in other words.
Well, that was a really interesting point.
Former members of the activist group Anti-Racist Action have ties to North Dakota and are planning to rally around the town of Leith and force Cobb out.
When there's lives at stake and when the integrity of your community is at stake, it's time to stand up.
No KKK, no fascist USA!
Our lives should not have to change because of one guy's agenda.
No Nazis! No KKK, no fascist USA!
You know, it's really funny because millions of whites have been driven out of their neighborhoods and cities by violence. And here we just have democracy and they want to drive us out.
Strong showing of support for Leith coming from North Dakota's Native Americans, who came here angry and ready to take on Craig Cobb and members of the National Socialist Movement.
You represent a dying cause.
So North Dakota, we got one thing to say to this. Go!
I think that the town shows remarkable solidarity and restraint against Cobb and his gang. Rich, what did you make of the community's response?
Well, I mean, they were terrified. Once they realized what was going on, they were really terrified. And there's one of the neighbors who lives just across the field who has a past. That the film kind of goes into his past, where he had a horrific experience when he lived in Washington.
Mm. His daughter was murdered.
His daughter was murdered, and he's moved out here to try to get away from that and rebuild his life. And now all of this comes in next door to him. And you see him buying guns and giving guns to his wife and, you know, terrified for his kids. He won't let them stay in the house alone. And you get this sense of what it must feel like to have someone like that living next door. And just the feeling, Well, especially when they're walking around with giant rifles all the time. Mm. And it's you know, the town kind of gets really freaked out. And it's quite nice that the people from the neighboring town kind of come to their rescue, basically, because there's just 24 of them. It's a tiny, they don't even have a police force. They use the sheriff, the county sheriff. And the county sheriff and his deputy are quite featured heavily, and they keep coming into the rescue as well. Mm. So it's nice that they get a lot of support from the surrounding neighborhood. You know, mm-hmm. people realize that this tiny little community is in jeopardy, and everyone comes to help them.
And so, it's good that we got, the filmmakers gave us access equally to Cobb and also the community and some of their stories. And Marcel, do you think the community acted in an appropriate way?
Oh, absolutely. And I think one of the main things that we see from that response was the multinational unity that's very prevalent. Again, you have the Standing Rock community, which has been in the news heavily over the past few years because of the Dakota Access Pipeline and intruding on their territory. So we've had the huge resistance at Standing Rock. So, you know, we see not just the immediate community, but we see the wider community, so to speak, rallying against these hateful elements. And although, yes, we're seeing a resurgence and, you know, a sort of coming out of the closet of these white supremacists in society today, we also see that there is a lot of resistance to this taking place in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. But going back to the film, that was a really good point. We see that the community kind of struggle against Cobb, and Cobb seems to have sort of, he asserts his rights and he has police protection. I mean, how does that make sense?
Well, I mean, it's very interesting. Just in the past few months, the FBI has put out reports about the domestic terror threat. And, you know, when you talk about domestic terrorism, because, of course, all of the focus on so-called terrorism in the United States is always about so-called Islamist terrorism. And mm-hmm. actually, these people are a much bigger threat to U.S. society. You know, but in the FBI report, they're actually putting on par so-called black identity extremists, as they call it. So, in other words, the Black Lives Matter movement and anti-racist activists, they're putting them on par with these white supremacists, which is exactly what Trump did when he said, well, what about the so-called alt-left, you know, in response to the alt-right? It's like, as if, you know, these very terrifying racists who walk around with these huge rifles, I think the term sexy rifles is used in the film, is somehow, you know, equivalent with people pushing back against that and struggling for equality. It's ridiculous. Yeah. But
there's no comparison. The right-wingers are threatening violence. They're going in proposing violence.
Right.
And is verbally. They're saying we're coming into, you know, blood's going to run down the streets. I mean, that's what they say.
And could you imagine?
Sorry to pause you there. We're just going to move on. We'll continue the discussion.
It began with the Southern Poverty Law Center. The Southern Poverty Law Center has stalked me for about 7 years. This is literally the fourth time via which they or their operatives have done this to me. That is, stalked me, gotten me fired, gotten me evicted, gotten me run out of countries even. I'm not young. You know, I'm an older guy. So why don't they say, just leave this cantankerous kind of odd fellow alone? No, they're not going to do that, you see. For some reason, they simply will not allow the infinitesimal few of us that there are to keep one another's company freely and openly.
In the early 2000s, the federal government was cracking down on white supremacists, and there was a high-level U.S. Attorney task force that was created to deal with that threat. The last time they were supposed to meet was actually on 9/11. The federal government turned on a dime very quickly for obvious reasons and focused almost all of its attention on Islamic extremism. Therefore, the government was left with no intelligence agencies fighting back against the kinds of groups that the Southern Poverty Law Center tracks. That's pretty serious. You know, there's a few hundred thousand of these people in the United States. Some of them, in the vein of Cobb, are willing to use weapons in ways that are dangerous. Some of them are willing to kill.
So there we saw Cobb with his hair cut and almost unrecognizable. And I want to talk about the wider issues now in the film. I think this part of the documentary was one of the most eye-opening parts. We see that after the advent of 9/11, that there was more of a crackdown on Muslims than white supremacists. Marcel, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this has been the dominant theme of counterterrorism in the United States since 9/11, definitely. And, you know, I think it's just come to the surface again in the past maybe year or 2 years that, well, there's actually, you know, vast number of white supremacists who are willing to, as she said, there kill. And, you know, like, you can see Cobb walking around in the streets with these huge rifles. I mean, could you imagine for a second this being two African Americans and the police having the same sort of response to them? You know, basically, like, oh, what are you doing here? Oh, you're just going to go home. All right, fine, sir. Please go on your way. And then they get arrested afterwards, of course. But, you know, we know very well that if this was an African American, you know, pair walking in the streets, so they would probably be gunned down by those same police officers, right? So, you know, you can see the relationship between Cobb and the white nationalists and the police forces and the authorities and powers that be as well. And I think that's such an important part of this documentary.
Mm-hmm. And Rich, if I could turn to you, we saw actually in the film that Kylan Dutton, one of Cobb's supporters in the film, he says that white children under the age of five are now the minority in the U.S. for the first time. And he's concerned about this. And do you think that they go to leave as a sort of sense of sanctuary, that they're under attack and they're being victimized?
Yeah, I don't think that statistic is true. In fact, I'm sure it's not. But, they're going there thinking, oh, we're under attack. You know, us white people are, you know, we're the persecuted. That's never been true, obviously. And it's not been true in history. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why they feel like they're under attack. I don't know. I can't.
Do you think it would have been good to explore that a bit more?
You listen to them talk and you think, it's very rare that I hear someone talk and I can't put my mind, you know, I can't see the situation through their eyes. Mm-hmm. And this guy, Kynan, was, and his wife is in the film as well. They talk, they're quite reasonable, they're quite articulate, mm-hmm. but I can't identify with anything they say. I can't, I can't sit there and say, oh, I see your point, because their point is just, it's just warped, it's wrong, and I don't know if they're, obviously they're just living in their circle of friends, and and they have news that they're believing, and they're not really paying attention to what's actually happening in the world.
Mm. It raises many questions, yes, and we get little glimpses into their lives.
And I think it's interesting in the film that, you know, it basically is a First Amendment issue, and America is unusual that hate speech is not illegal in America. Mm-hmm. It's protected. So people can say the most horrifying things. They can fly their swastikas, which you can't do in Europe. You can't say those things in Europe, but you can say them there. And it's a different legal situation. So that's why you watch it, and it's for a European especially, it's really horrifying to see, because you couldn't do that in Europe.
Well, I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there on that note. And please do watch this documentary. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. And don't forget to leave your comments and your thoughts regarding our show. I've been Camila Shambayati, and see you on the next episode of Doc Review.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.